Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Later in the show, we'll hear about how Exxon-funded think tanks spread climate denial in Latin America. But first, we're discussing new reporting on the potential deaths caused by Trump's anti-green agenda. According to an article co-published by ProPublica and The Guardian, extra greenhouse gases released in the next decade as a result of the Trump administration's policies are expected to lead to as many as 1.3 million more climate deaths worldwide in the 80 years after 2035. The poorest and hottest countries, particularly those in Africa and South Asia, are expected to bear the brunt of this cost, while the United States will account for 1% of these additional deaths. Though these additional 1.3 million climate deaths are a small portion of the total estimated 83 million temperature-related deaths that could result from human-caused global emissions if this pollution is not curtailed, it serves as a warning of the outsized role the U.S. is playing in producing greenhouse gases. Joining us to talk about this report is Sharon Lerner, an investigative reporter for ProPublica. Sharon Lerner covers health and the environment and the agencies that govern them, including the EPA. Sharon joined ProPublica in 2022 after 7 years as an investigative reporter at The Intercept. Sharon Lerner has received a number of awards for her reporting, including being honored by the Society of Environmental Journalists 12 times. Hi, Sharon. Thanks so much for your work, and thank you for joining us again.
Hi, Rose. Thanks for having me. Nice to be here.
Well, what a headline, Sharon. Trump's anti-green agenda could lead to 1.3 million more climate deaths, and the poorest countries will be impacted the most. I mean, as you know, you've been doing this for a long time, Sharon. This news is just coming at us so fast, and it's pretty intense.
I know.
Can you talk about the modeling that you used? You used modeling by independent researchers?
So, first let me say about the depressing part, and it's overwhelming, and there's so much news out there now. And I know that's true. And it's really hard to read about this stuff. It's hard to write about this stuff. Yep. But I embarked on this piece because I just was thinking, I think we're, a lot of us are watching what's been happening lately with Trump and the new administration. And it's so hard, as you said, all these things happening so quickly, all these policies. And a lot of the changes that we've seen have had to do with the climate, right? And I began thinking, well, what will the impact be? You know, and we know that increased emissions causes increased heat, and increased heat ultimately will kill, because we're already seeing heat-related deaths for climate change. So I just wanted to say that this piece came from the question of how many deaths will we see? Is it, you know, possible to figure that out? And when I started talking to scientists about this and climate economists, it turns out that it is possible to estimate. Of course, you know, the numbers in this piece are estimates, because we're not in the future yet. We're predicting, but these economists and scientists are able to use modeling, computer modeling, sophisticated models that we're modeling in two parts of this piece. So the first is that we use modeling from this independent group called Rhodium Group that estimates the impact of energy policies and studies energy policies. And what they did was they looked at what greenhouse gas emissions will be over the next 10 years under the current scenario, which is like all the rollbacks that have been put in place by Trump, versus what is the amount of emissions that will happen, that would have happened if the Biden policies had stayed in place and Trump hadn't made any of the changes he had. And we subtracted one from the other, right? So there are more emissions under Trump than there would have been had he not come into office. And so when you find that difference between the Trump policies and the Biden era policies, that's the kind of amount of emissions we're looking at. So we were looking between 2025 right now and 2035. And for those who don't know, greenhouse gas emissions are the gases from industry that warm the planet, right? So we're looking at these 10 years worth of emissions. And so then we use another bit of kind of amazing science that's come out recently from climate scientists. And that's this metric called the mortality cost of carbon. And what this is that this economist, this climate economist named Danny Bressler, figured out, and again, it's an estimate, but he's using health studies and lots of data that show the relationship between increasing emissions and deaths. And basically his metric allows you to figure out for each additional metric ton of carbon, how many heat or temperature related deaths can you expect? And so we combine those things. We took the amount of extra emissions, Rhodium Group figured out, right? And we multiplied it by this metric that Bressler has come up with, which says for every additional metric ton of greenhouse gases, how many deaths will you have? And we found that the max for temperature related deaths was 1.3 million.
And most of the people expected to die from these soaring temperatures in the coming decades live in poor, hot countries in places like Africa and South Asia.
That is true. That's what the modeling shows. And so there's an interesting piece of this. So as temperatures, let me back up for a sec. So we're talking about temperature-related deaths, which is kind of a weird term. And what that really means is that over time, as the temperature gets hotter and hotter, which is what's been happening, what will continue to happen, two things happen. Well, a lot of things happen. But in terms of temperature-related deaths, there are two things. One, there's an increase in heat-related deaths. But two, there's actually also a decrease in cold-related deaths because a lot of people die from cold. So the number that we're looking at that this mortality cost of carbon generates is the heat-related deaths minus the kind of number of people who won't die from cold. And, you know, in the short term, they kind of cancel each other out in the very near term because there are quite a few people now dying from cold who won't die from cold. But what happens is as you look at the modeling and as the world gets hotter and hotter, you see that the deaths from heat greatly outpace the reduction in the deaths from cold. Mm-hmm. And so, so of course, where are you going to see that? You're going to see that in countries that are already hot. So places in equatorial Africa, for instance, in Somalia, in parts of Pakistan and India, that's where you're going to see places that are already hot are going to be even hotter, and thus it's more dangerous. Now, the poor part, partly many of those countries are poor, that's what we're talking about. But also there's another piece of this, which is how much can a country afford to adapt, you know, to heat in rising temperatures. So in the United States, we already have a great deal of air conditioning, right? So when it gets really hot, a lot of people go indoors and that's how they survive it. In many countries, air conditioning is not the norm and they can't survive it. That's not an option. And so that's another piece of it is that the places that can't afford to adapt will also be hit the hardest. Also, I should mention in your introduction, you mentioned that I think the U.S. will only have 1% of temperature-related deaths. But in truth, that 1% is only, it doesn't consider adaptation. So when you look at the, and again, these are predictions, but the modeling says that if The U.S. continues to adapt to rising temperatures. We'll probably see a 0% change in deaths, because we will be able to adapt.
We are speaking with ProPublica's Sharon Lerner about her latest piece, Trump's Anti-Green Agenda Could Lead to 1.3 Million More Climate Deaths. The poorest countries will be impacted the most. Sharon will be with us for 15 more minutes, so if you have any questions for her about this, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. Sharon, can we also step back and talk about the changes that we saw under the Biden administration on climate? In your piece, you quoted Marshall Burke, an economist at the Dorr School of Sustainability at Stanford, who said, "Prior to Trump, we had the most ambitious climate policy that the U.S. has ever come up with, our best effort to date by far of addressing this growing problem." So can you remind us? So many frontline communities were constantly protesting and demanding that the Biden administration take more action on the climate crisis.
Right. But as you mentioned, it's important to realize that we were in the best position we have been yet in regard to climate during under the Biden administration. And that's because Biden recognized the need to reduce emissions. His plan was to get to net zero by 2050. We weren't quite on track to do that, but he had put lots, and his administration had put lots and lots of policies in place that were going to reduce greenhouse emissions. They primarily through the IRA, the Inflation Reduction Act. There are all these tax credits to promote electronic vehicles and solar and wind, and to hugely change the trajectory of our energy use so that we're relying on renewables more. And there are all sorts of policies to switch over to electric school buses. It was really this across the board push to lower emissions. And we really didn't get much time to see it working. It was just beginning to be phased in when Trump came in and, of course, reversed most of these things and has gone, and it should be said, not, of course, not based on science, because we know that greenhouse gas emissions heat the planet. We already know this is a huge problem. We're seeing all sorts of extreme weather events already. We're seeing the effects of climate change. We hit the 1.5 Celsius, mark in terms of, we've already seen much more heating than we wanted to see. And we all know around the world, countries know they're all gathered in Brazil right now to try to address this because it will cause economic devastation and it will kill people. And it is already killing people. So this is what, we were beginning to address before Trump came in and essentially reversed it all.
And tell us what strikes you the most about what we've seen under the second Trump administration. As you write, this administration, sometimes with the help of congressional Republicans, has dramatically set back efforts to limit climate change, cutting tax credits for clean electricity, fuels, vehicles, and manufacturing, easing pollution restrictions on coal-fired power plants, and gutting fuel standards on cars, to name just a few of the initiatives that were recently reversed.
So I guess the main what stands out to me is that this isn't based on reason. It's like it is not, I mean, the it's not they don't even offer a rationale that makes any sense except to say that it's good for business. But we know actually that there are all these green businesses that are now suffering, the solar industry and the wind and all the various efforts that were underway were also businesses, right? And we also know that the rest of the world is carrying on in a rational way. That means that they are continuing to pursue to transition to renewable energy and to China is going gangbusters with solar and with electric cars. So it's not a rational approach here. It seems to be a very, not just very short-sighted and, but it's a political approach where I think that it seems to stem from the satisfaction of reversing the policies of your political enemies and potentially serving, the fossil fuel industry. But even, sometimes the fossil fuel industry is saying that these things are going so far. So it's the rationale, there isn't one really. Not a satisfying one.
You also report that in the bill that the Republicans passed, which again has massive tax cuts for the ultra wealthy and corporations, the tax incentives for solar and wind energy have been cut. The bill makes it easier and cheaper to drill or mine on federal lands. It reverses efforts to cut emissions of methane, another greenhouse gas, and it increases government support for coal.
Yeah.
How should we be thinking about this, Sharon? Because I think about all the shows we've done with scientists who have said over the years that we really need to make a drastic change by the year 2035. That is the year that they really point to. And that year is so incredibly important. And we talked a lot about that. How should we be thinking about what these policies will mean for the next 10, 20 years?
Well, I don't know if we want to think about the next. I think that what we do in the next 10, 20 years affects generations to come. So I think that's a big part of it. And I don't want to be even more gruesome and depressing, but like you mentioned at the top of the show that, this 1.3 figure is again for, just the additional emissions that the U.S. will release because of Trump policies. But if you look at greenhouse gas emissions, industrial, created by people, right? And you look at the effect on temperature, the worst case scenario generates, using the mortality cost of carbon metric, an estimate of 83 million people by 2100 will have died due to the changes in temperature. But here's the depressing part, as if that were not depressing enough, is that that's just temperature-related deaths. Mm-hmm. So it's not all the other things that flow from climate change, like tornadoes and wildfires and wars and famine. I guess partly, it's wrapping our heads around that, right? And then it's also realizing, yes, most of these effects will be felt in poorer countries, but you can't separate what will happen in those parts of the countries from the rest of the world. I mean, those kinds of dramatic and awful changes will cause political and instability throughout the world. So you can't, I'm afraid that this America First agenda, which is driving all this, gives it the sense of like, okay, well, we'll be fine. And so it doesn't matter. Well, if you're going to take that position, which of course is completely unethical because we're killing people around the world, even so, you have to reckon with the fact that the world, all of us, our country too, would be forever changed.
And it's important to point out in your piece that Niger and Somalia, whose emissions are dwarfed by those of the U.S., are projected to have the world's highest per capita death rates from increasing temperatures. India is expected to suffer more temperature-related deaths than any other country. Pakistan, which has just 3% of the world's population, is expected to have between 6 and 7% of the world's temperature-related deaths, depending on its ability to adapt to the effects of the heat. And in your piece, Sharon, you have such a devastating story of a man holding his 3-year-old son who died during a 2015 heat wave. And this is in Karachi, Pakistan. So, I mean, this is happening now. Today, yeah. We're joined by ProPublica reporter Sharon Lerner, talking about her piece, Trump's anti-green agenda could lead to 1.3 million more climate deaths. The poorest countries will be impacted the most. Let's hear from a listener. Let's go to John in Berkeley. Hi, John. Welcome to the show.
Hello. My question is the compounding influence of if it gets above 130 degrees Fahrenheit, people die, but also crop failures.
Right.
Sharon, you alluded to famines, crop failures, and livestock deaths.
Yep.
So the massive famine that's going to occur by 2050, in the next 25 years, in equatorial Africa and India and Pakistan, Bangladesh.
Yep.
If you could address that.
Yeah, I mean, you've said it. It's like it's... it's huge. And when, you know, originally when I was asking scientists about like what good metrics are there out there to gauge any of this, you know, we have this great mortality cost of carbon, but it is very narrow. So, you know, my fear in doing this piece was that people would read this number and think, oh, 1.3, that's not too bad. Or I don't know what people would think, but somehow they might be, you know, think of this as, you know, as not significant, but it's really only a small piece of the devastation we'll see. You're completely right.
Yeah, this is so important. And every year we're getting information from like the World Meteorological Organization saying that last year was the warmest year on record. And I was just searching for the highest temperatures in 2024, and I mean, these, you can't even comprehend this. Death Valley, California, 129 degrees on July 7th. Aswan, Egypt, 121. Las Vegas, 120. Reading, California, 119. Delhi, India, 127. I mean, these numbers are so hard to comprehend.
They're not survivable unless you can crawl into air conditioning, but you can't. Right. That's not an inhabitable place. It's 120 degrees.
Wow. Well, thank you for the call, John. We'll definitely do more shows about the issue that you raised. Let's hear from Phil in Novato. Hi, Phil. Welcome to the show.
Hi. One thing that I was amazed at with the Kamala Harris campaign, that they never made any thing about climate change. There was a big Hurricane Helene in the East Coast, and either the first or second question in the VP debate, Tim Walz got the question about, you know, what was a campaign going to do for climate change because of all the devastation that Hurricane Helene was doing. And they came. Tim Walz gave this answer that he came off like he'd never heard of climate change, and why? And Trump was extremely vulnerable on this, and how the Harris campaign could have said that's absolutely nothing on this, you know, civilization-threatening issue was just so pathetic. That I hope that voters demand any future candidates to address this and not be completely clueless like her campaign and the Walz campaign were on this issue. I mean, it was just incredible. Thank you.
Thank you. Any thoughts on that, Sharon?
I agree with striking the silence from both parties on this issue when, you know, it's something, it's bigger really than most any of the other issues we're all dealing with. And yes, complete silence. I did notice that as well.
I just remember her always saying it's an existential threat and really hardly talking about the Biden policies that she was heavily involved with, especially for frontline communities.
Right, they did so much. They did so much, right. And right, but not to talk about it during the campaign. Yes, for sure.
Right. Yeah. And to Phil's point, just quickly, Sharon, there was an interesting piece in the Washington Post recently, actually 10 days ago, the big issue Democrats have stopped talking about. An analysis of lawmakers' appearances and social media posts show that they're going quiet on climate. And some of the people interviewed in this piece say, you know, because people are feeling economically secure, insecure, the Democrats are talking about that. And of course, they're talking about Trump, but not really talking about climate change anymore.
Yeah, even in New York City, where I live, and we had this amazing mayoral race, and Zoran Mamdani won. And he's a, you know, he's someone who has taken action on the climate and cares about the climate, but that was not part of the campaign or the conversation around the election. Mm.
Well, Sharon, final thoughts on this. I mean, it's such a devastating piece. We also have an email from Eileen who says, have you talked about migration? No one's going to just sit around waiting to die from starvation and heat.
Mm-hmm. No, it was certainly a big part of this. I will just say, in terms of final thoughts, I appreciate your having me on to talk about it, because it is really difficult to talk about. And I know that people would really rather read and think about other things. Apparently, you know, they can stomach, you know, Jeffrey Epstein even more than like this, because it's just so very upsetting. And I think we feel that very powerless when we think about the how overwhelming it is. But I will say that there's this flip side from, you know, from learning about all this. Really, the heart of what this economist Bressler is showing is that additional emissions kill. But the flip side of that is that when you reduce emissions, you save lives. Mm. So I think we need to think about it that way. Like, every time we can find a way to reduce emissions, we're saving lives. And I do think that, you know, that's both makes it easier to read and think about, and also easier to do something about, to feel motivated to do something about.
Sharon Lerner is an investigative reporter for ProPublica, covering health and the environment and the agencies that govern them, including the EPA. You can find Sharon's latest piece, Trump's Anti-Green Agenda Could Lead to 1.3 Million More Climate Deaths. The poorest countries will be impacted the most. ProPublica.org or our website, KALW.org. Click news and your call. Sharon, thank you so much for your important work, and thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. Coming up after a break, we will talk about a new DSMOG report, how Exxon exported climate denial to the global south. We'll also get an update on the climate conference in Brazil. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this.